Welcome, welcome, welcome. You thought I wasn't going to do my three welcomes, but I always do my three welcomes. Fear not, true believer. Yeah, we've got Rob the Bank this week, who's one of my favourite people. And this was not only one of my favourite podcasts, but one of my favourite conversations I've had in ages. It was so lovely to catch up with Robbie. I need to do the sponsors first, though. We're sponsored by Speech Development Records. That's my record label. Come and check us out. Go to scroobiuspip.co.uk and you can look at the web store there. Or you can go and play the Bash the Beard game, where you just play about with a game about making my beard grow. So there's that. You can also head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com to go straight to the web store. Genuinely makes a difference, man. If you can buy some stuff, buy a mug, a t-shirt, anything that tickles your fancy. I've stolen this from a JR podcast, the Ross Report, but it's free to look. It's free to look. Just head there, have a look. You don't even have to close this podcast. It will keep playing. It's free to look, so check that out. And if you fancy buying anything, that'd be lovely. Our other sponsor is onit.com. They are a human optimizational website. I've mentioned them a lot, but it's because I genuinely use them. All the sponsors of this podcast are people I use. They sell a lot of fitness stuff, whether it be weights or like these battle mace things, like a lot of CrossFit stuff, but also supplements. Both fitness and mental kind of fitness. I use one called Alpha Brain to just keep sharp. It kind of helps your long-term and short-term memory, your general perception and sharpness. I like it. Check them out. And you know what? Just because you're listening to this podcast, you can get 10% off if you go to onit.com/scroobiuspip. That's onnit.com/scroobiuspip, which is S-C-R-O-O-B-I-U-S. A lot of people think it's I-O-U-S. It's not. It's I-U-S, then P-I-P. Check us out. But let's get on to the podcast. This is the lovely, 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 lovely Mr. Rob the Bank. I'll be back at the end. See you in a bit. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. It's my nice little mobile setup.
Yeah.
I'm joined right now by Mr. Rob the Bank. How you doing, sir?
Afternoon.
Thank you very much for giving me a bit of your time. We're at Bestival headquarters. You've invited me into the to come in the Batcave and everything.
It's a bit stark in here, actually, isn't it? It's like a sort of a stark white blocky building overlooking a block of flats. It's not really maybe what you'd expect from Bestival HQ.
That's what I found particularly beautiful about it, because it's you know, it's from such darkness that such darkness should surely influence and inspire the beauty of Bestival and all of
the
that.
The beauty of a green field site full of wonderful happenings, and here we are in South London, like surrounded by council blocks.
Dreaming of it. You've got to keep hungry throughout the year.
Not that there's anything wrong with council blocks.
No, they're good. I've said this a few times on the podcast, and this one is as relevant as ever. The podcast has kind of become an excuse for me to have a reason to sit down and talk to people that I adore and don't get enough time to catch up with and hang out with. So this is just an excuse for us to hang out. There just happens to be microphones here. So, yeah, how are you? Is everything going well?
It's good, yeah. I've just been on a bit of a self-enforced sabbatical, 9 weeks out of the rat race with the kids. So
you've been teasing us all on Instagram.
And teasing you with photos
for months.
Me in temples and with monkeys and
it looked amazing though.
Yeah, it was a life changer. You know, I think I've spent, you know, 20 years like working really hard on a lot of things, and I'm not very good at cutting myself any slack, so I thought for once, okay. It was just after I'd left Radio 1 and I thought, right, okay, this could be a good time to, well, it's the only time I've had in the last 12 years where I don't have to be doing something every week. So it was a luxury.
It's such a weird thing when you've got on, and it's hard to comprehend if you've not, but when you've got a job that is in entertainment in any way, it's hard for people to get their head around how, because, you know, you've probably not had a proper break or holiday in years, but people will think of it, oh, you do Bestival, you go to all these nice festivals, or you DJ at all these nice places, but it is all work and it is all harder work. That part of the art is making it look easy, if you know what I mean.
I mean, I would never complain about it or say it was harder work than, you know, working in a biscuit factory or being a lollipop lady or, you know, driving a taxi or anything. But the thing about it is it's all consuming. So, you know, I wake up and I'm instantly like kind of working in my head, like, how are we going to sell more tickets today? Who am I going to book for this? So, and that's all, you know, that's all my own fault for having this amazing job, and I love it. But sometimes, you're just like, oh, I could actually do with... I sort of sometimes look at people with a 9-to-5, and people with a 9-to-5 are probably going to look at the radio now and just go, F off to bank. But I sort of... I've never probably ever had that sort of thing where I can just switch off on a Friday afternoon and have the weekend sort of off. At the same time, I don't want a 9-to-5, so, yeah.
It's one of the things I realised only in the last few years that... And it's probably different with somewhere as vastly different as India and so far from everything, or, you know. But it's harder to enjoy or have a holiday if you've not got a boss to have a holiday from. If you're the boss, then, you know, if you've got a weekend off, you're still thinking about Bristol. You've not got that kind of, oh, God, I don't have to deal with him till Monday. It's like, you are your boss kind of thing. So it's kind of, it's a weird one. It's hard to switch off, right?
Yeah. But I am getting to learn, and we've got, you know, got a brilliant team here. So there's you know, it's best of all, it's not like me and Josie and John and Ziggy run everything. It's like, there's a big team of people running it. And it's all about, what's the word when you, delegation. You know, delegating and kind of, there's so many people that are, you know, gagging to do what we're doing on Bestel, so it's just a case of letting them get on with it.
Yeah, it's got to be a hard thing to let go of the reins, but the first time you do that and you see amazing results, you got to go, why didn't I do this ages ago? Why have I been doing so much work for myself when there's these amazing people who can help out and pull it off?
But at the same time, I am a complete control freak, so I do find it very difficult to. Particularly on the lineups, you know, I get very tetchy if anyone sort of tries to get involved in that, Pip. I really do.
People without your permission.
But I'm sort of starting to get a bit. I've got someone working with me now, this lovely girl Ellie, and she's sort of helped me book the DJs. So you know, that's the first step of me actually
Definitely right. And I mean, I've got it down to what, 3 emails a year now of people I'm recommending and asking you to book and get into play. So that's, you know, that's a good step in the right direction.
I welcome that kind of, you know, input from mates and you know, artists and people like that is good. To be honest, even in house, you know, it's nice to have lots of ideas. The trouble
is, it's important to keep it all fresh like that. I mean, I feel even from just booking the spoken word for 4 or 5 years now at Bestival and Camp Bestival, is this year I've kind of gone, right, I'm putting a lot of, although they all go down well, I'm putting a lot of the same people on each year. I need to adjust that and get out of my comfort zone a bit. So again, it's that kind of thing I'm having this year, and that's a tiny part of the festival. That's not the massive bulk of it that you're having to deal with. So it's important, I guess, to get people to say, because there's been a few spoken word artists I've booked and said, who do you rate? You know, now who do you think is good? To kind of try and get that, so it's not just Pip and his mates here again every year, just doing things, which is good in its own right, but important to breathe that life into it.
That's exactly it. And a lot of people do want Pip and his mates. You know, they do. Yeah. They want Kate Tempest and they want Polar Bear and they want all the guys and girls that you book. So in a way you're sort of like, oh God, if I book that person then I can't book Kate or I can't do this.
It's getting the balance, isn't it?
It's getting the balance. And you know, every year I think I talk to you about it at Bestival. I want Bestival to be braver and more kind of out there and encompass more kinds of music. It's already quite broad, but you know, I want more heavy metal, I want more thrash, I want more sort of Latin, I don't know, I want more like Brazilian stuff. I don't book anywhere near enough world music. But then suddenly I find myself in now, you know, February, March, and it's like the budget's gone and yet again I haven't booked, you know, that artist.
Of course.
Because it just gets soaked up and it's so frustrating. I really wish I had an unlimited pot of money to book it and the festival went on all year and then I'd probably...
Just constantly amazing. Who was it last year? Was it... pitch shifter or censor. I always get those two acts confused, but it was an act on the main stage kind of early on one day that were quite metally and quite heavy, and I walked past it, and it was on paper it seems like the craziest time and place for this act, but it was so perfect. Just the whole crowd was losing
it. The sort of Saturday lunchtime circle pit mosh time, which Gallows kicked off 2 years ago.
Yeah,
and I just thought, right, you know, heavy metal, you know, whatever, rock, hard rock is not my thing, but actually, you know, there's a lot of people that come to Bestall that possibly it is on the side or just one of their main passions, and so it's become a bit of a sort of Saturday lunchtime in the sun, let's go down and sort of see something different. And last year it was Skindred
last year, right.
And the lead singer, or what, you know, he's just such an amazing and I'm sure he's used to just doing, you know, preaching to the converted. And I also like the fact that for him, it was probably like, well, this crowd, man, there's, you know, there's about 10,000 people there at that time. You know, I need to do some work on this. But he had them...
It worked the crowd perfectly. He did a really simple thing that was just perfect for... Because, again, at that time of day, you're not going to have everyone there, and you're not going to have everyone drunk and in a mess kind of thing. So he did a simple thing on one song where he got people to just spin their shirts or whatever they've got above their head, and it went through the whole crowd and looked absolutely amazing. That was perfect use of that time slot and nailing it. I do want to go back to the start and go for everything, but while we're on Bestival, kind of talk us through how that's been, like how it started to where it is now. Obviously it's always been beautiful for me seeing you and Josie and the kind of the beautiful art project of a festival it kind of is, so, you know, grow into this huge entity. And now, I mean, you've just announced a Bestival Canada. You know, it's a global thing. I've asked a lot of questions there to deal with. So.
No, but I'm glad you called it an art project, because actually in the last couple of years that's sort of how I've started referring to it, because I've realised that that's kind of what it is. And most of my mates, and you know, Josie and most of my mates are artists. They're either filmmakers or painters or you know, visual artists or something. And I think I was always frustrated at school that I was rubbish at art and not that great at music either. Well, I was actually rubbish at everything. So, but it's all sort of happened accidentally. But I've always loved, you know, that creative thing, and I think at the end of the day that's what it is putting on a big party, and that's kind of an arty thing. It's like a huge art installation. So
there are always them complete art elements. I remember walking in 2 years ago and seeing the ship and just being like, wow, they've just built a massive ship in the middle of a field, like a full-size it's absolutely amazing.
Cruise ship, I mean, you know, 90% of people that saw that ship that first year and even last year still think that we've craned in a wreck of a ship from somewhere, and don't realise that if you stand around the back that it's just like scaffolding and amazing paintwork and really legendary sort of set building.
It's absolutely insane.
But yeah, that, you know, that's a good example of, you know, and the giant disco ball last year. And
yeah, that was an amazing moment as well. When that was finally raised, but then previously a Lionel Richie head, just stuff like that. It's kind of how does that all come about? Is it all just you and your friends and Joseph and everyone just coming up with these things and going, what insane things can we do this year?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, you know, when we started Bestival 12 years ago, then there weren't that many festivals going, and there was, you know, it was Glastonbury and Reading, and it was like the Phoenix Festival and a few others that aren't going, but and you know, there was the Big Chill, Secret Garden was just starting out as well, but there wasn't that much competition, but we were newbies and we needed to make a splash, so we were like, okay, what can we do differently? So, you know, we had the Hidden Disco, we had the whole fancy dress dressing up thing, we had the world's smallest disco, and you know, we just thought we need things to make us stand out, and I think that's just carried on because the competition's got fiercer and it's fun, and you know, so it's like people want to see something different, you know, and the disco ball was probably the pinnacle of our achievements in that, because it just totally nailed it. Everyone talked about it all summer, and then it sort of actually had this massive culmination at the festival, and it's going to be really hard to beat because the amount of sort of press and goodwill and sort of feel good factor that created was just, not stop for us. So.
I was thinking exactly that, because one of the best things, and Bestival and Camp Bestival are two of, obviously, when I'm gigging in festival season, there's a lot of festivals, and they're the two that I generally stay all weekend. And the Bestival and Camp Bestival closing fireworks have always been an amazing thing, and one of the things you look to. Are they going to be as exciting next year after this year's raising of the disco ball? It's kind of no. How do you
with
top
Nile
that?
Rodgers introducing the big lift of the disco ball? Well, I think I think we sort of struggled to think, okay, well, how are we going to better that? But then actually, we don't need to. I think it was a moment in time. I mean, 5 years ago, completely. I was climbing up a huge pile of petrol-soaked wood, dressed as a spaceman. And then pretending to fly off to space and the whole thing being torched and me playing out on John's Rocket Man off the top. So, you know, that was an amazing installation, you know, the big burn that year. And so the disco ball will go, you know, for us, will go down in history, you know, it's our own little best all history. And it was a great, great moment. But if we tried to better it every year on the Sunday night, it would just fall flat. Yeah, but we've got some cool, really cool stuff. Like next week we're announcing a festival within a festival. So...
This is going to be going out in about 3 or 4 weeks, so that will already have been announced. So feel free to go into it if you don't want to. You know, it's obviously I promise it's not going to go out and ruin any announcements.
Okay, cool. Yeah, as long as you don't leak it, then.
No, I promise I won't.
Okay, yeah. Well, we've got this whole new area called Slow Motion, which is basically its own festival within Bestival. So the whole of the sort of Tomorrow's World area, if people come to Bestival, you'll know where I'm talking, where the bandstand is, and where possibly it's all a bit slower.
Yeah,
and so. That whole area and the woodland and everything is becoming its own look and feel. It's like yoga, meditation, mindfulness, you know, good eating, like mad sort of wild runs. We're going to have people taking people off for surfing lessons and kite surfing off site and bringing them back and stuff. So creating this whole other world within Bestival for people that maybe, you know, either it's got a bit too lively for them or they just, you know, they want to go and see the Chemical Brothers on Saturday night, but then the Sunday they just want to have a totally different experience.
To recover from the Chemical Brothers on Saturday night.
So we're really excited about that. So
that's amazing.
I mean, things like that are sort of pushing us, you know, in a way that like the disco ball would have done, and it might not be as visually easy to grasp. It's not as fun, but it's I think it's going to reset where we're at with Bestival, because me and Josie both noticed last year, although the crowd, you know, is young, you know, predominantly still a young crowd, which I love, because otherwise we'll all grow old and die. Then I think they look after themselves. I think it sounds a bit old fogish, but I really believe this, that younger people generally are looking after themselves better. I don't know if you when I was growing up, either my mates were sort of fat or spotty or sort of weaklings like me.
Yeah.
You know, we were all sort of a type, and now you look at kids going around festivals, you know, whether they got their tops off or not, and it's like everyone looks like they look after themselves. Yeah. And
I think it's a massive thing now with, and again, I think Camp Bestival was the first one I noticed it to really go in on the food side of things and make a feature of the fact that you've got really good people in to do the food, to have a really varied cuisine. But still, I don't think any festival has nailed a really genuinely healthy and, that whole, whether it be dietary or spiritually or anything else, that definitely sounds like a good...
There are obviously festivals which are entirely kind of that, but that's a different sort of experience. It's not so much a sort of contemporary music festival. So I think, you know, and people obviously they have their healing areas or they have this bits of this and that, but we're actually, you know, creating a haven so that, you know, whether you want to spend the whole weekend in there or whether you just want to come in for a few hours or 10 minutes, it will feel like a whole different kettle of fish. And I think whether you're a 25-year-old who... you know, has come down for a massive rave up all weekend, or whether you're 50 or 60, and you know, I want those people to keep coming back to Bestival. I don't want it to be ageist. I want everyone to be able to come there, and whatever you're into, I hope this will be an exciting new venture.
Yeah, provided that's great. Was it a conscious thing to? Because I kind of feel that Bestival, Glastonbury, and maybe a Secret Garden Party a bit. Feel like the only festivals to me that people as much as the amazing and varied and strong lineups each year, there's a huge amount of people who go just because it's Bestival and just because of that whole experience. I always remember our sound man, James, one year, came along when we were playing, and other than our set, he didn't actually come on and see any bands, but he had a lovely weekend of camping and engaging and doing all nice, lovely things. And yeah, he was like, yeah, I love Bestival. I wasn't in the mood for watching any bands. I love it as an experience, the vibe, everyone.
He's just your number one fan, isn't he? Yeah, he only wanted to watch you, and then anything else would have been a disappointment.
If anyone else had paid him to watch him, he would have watched them as well. But so he wouldn't have watched us unless we were paying him. But yeah, was that a conscious thing to try and go, right, I guess there weren't as many festivals then, but there are a lot of festivals now, and I think a lot of them are very dependent on who is available that in their price range and who they can get and that kind of thing. Whereas as Bestival seem to be one of the ones that strived out to say, look, regardless of who we've got, it's going to be one of the best weekends of your year. And, you know, you always know that the vibe is right. I've spoken before of when Abbey Dolan came over and played, and he did a blog afterwards because he was like, I've played tons of festivals in America, but I've never been anywhere that just walking around, everyone seemed so happy and nice and friendly, and there didn't seem to be any aggro or any anger or threat, or it just seemed like the safest, nicest, friendliest place. So was that the kind of plan from the outset, even more so than I really want to book some amazing bands?
It wasn't, to be honest, like, being totally truthful, I totally get what you're saying, and I think us, Secret Garden, Glastow, we all do get that sort of feel good factor of people wanting to come, whatever. But equally, you remember like about 5-6 years ago when Glastonbury didn't sell out, and it was like a massive shock.
Yeah, of course.
So you know, and personally, I think we could sell. I reckon we could sell half our tickets without announcing the lineup.
Yeah.
But we definitely couldn't sell the other half without announcing some big acts. Yeah, and I think whether we've shot ourselves in the foot or whether we've just set it up like this, you know, we've had Elton, we've had Kraftwerk, we've had Amy Winehouse, we've had Beastie Boys, you know, we've had Stevie Wonder, you know, Chic. It's like people do want those acts. So I think there's definitely a sort of aspect that people will come whatever, and I think there's a, you know, that great sort of not gang mentality, but you know, it's like, oh yeah, we're all going down, and you know, people go in big
again,
groups.
I think the fancy dress influences that and everything, all stuff that seems to have been almost stumbled upon, that's become an identity, that it's like, yeah, we're all going to go, oh, what costume, like, what's the theme and all that kind of thing.
What are you going to wear? I love that. I would love to be able to just, you know, sell out without even booking a band. It would save us a lot of money. We might actually make some money from Festival one day. But it wasn't really the main thing at the start. No, I mean, although it's sort of, because we started off at 4,000 people, and then next year we sold 8,000, the next year we sold 16,000, the next year we sold 25,000. So we almost doubled in size every year, and we couldn't really, we didn't know what we were doing right. We were just like riding this wave, and for like...
Just keep going.
Yeah, just keep going. And then we got up to sort of 30, 35, 40,000. We were like, okay, you know, what are we going to do? And then when we got to 50,000, we were like, okay, let's put the sort of brakes on. And that was 3 or 4 years ago. So, you know, we could have tried to keep going, and I don't know what would have happened. Maybe we'd have ended up like a Tea in the Park size at 80,000 and or Glastonbury, but I don't think we would have. I think we sort of reached our natural capacity, and each year we sell out. But you know, it's not like the good old days where, you know, you'd sell out in 2 months and then
there's no nerves. There's still no nerves.
My day job is selling tickets. You know,
I mean, it's a hell of a thing though as well, particularly when you think about. You're selling out a 50,000 or whatever it is tickets to a festival that people have to get on a ferry to come to. That's a lot of effort. That's a lot. It's not like a lot of festivals where we'll drive up the road.
Don't tell everyone it's a lot of effort.
It's great though. It's great that people put that effort in, and equally they get there and they want to get dressed up and do fancy dress every day rather than originally. This day is fancy dress day in general. It's like as soon as you get on the island, it's fancy dress day. You go in Tesco's as you come off the ferry, and there's fancy dress people in there. So that's a great thing.
Well, I mean, yeah, for, I salute, you know, all the people that do make that journey. And yeah. I think they enjoy it, you know, and people, you wouldn't do it if you didn't enjoy it. And sometimes when we get it wrong, or when the ferry companies get it wrong, or, you know, and there's a 6-hour delay getting off the island, then people, you know, it's not maybe so much fun. And,
sure,
and
sure.
So it's, you know, I'm just being completely honest and frank here, because you can't try and pretend that having to get a ferry somewhere is everyone's cup of tea. But for the most part, on a sunny day, when you're kind of on there with like 2,000 other people all off to Bestival for the weekend, you've all left all your worries behind you. And I still get that when I get onto the island ferry every, you know, whenever I, which is where I live. And, you know, I definitely feel a small weight off my shoulders, because it's like
great.
I'm leaving the mainland behind. And, you know, I think that there is a massive buzz from that. So, the journey home is probably not so much fun when everyone's been up for 72 hours and not eaten. And
but thankfully, it's always a strong enough weekend that that's not the bit that stays in your head. I'll completely confess, there's been points I've got home and thought, oh God, because it's been late or something, or I've had to drive through the night. And then, you know, you give it a few days and you're like, I can't wait for next year. What's been... This is a kind of a twofold one. One of the things I've always enjoyed about Bestival is it's not... necessarily, obviously you've got your headliners, but it's not necessarily booked stage by stage on a ranking in the industry. It's often booked on what will work at that time and what's good and what should go here and what would suit the areas, which I think is a great thing, rather than going, oh, this band's above us, that's because they've sold X amount. It's rather, here's what flows and works nicely.
You've just summed that up so nicely. I wish you could go and tell all the agents and managers in the world that's the plan, because you've totally hit the nail on the head, and it's so hard to...
It's what sits and works right. That's kind of...
Yeah, which is how I think it should be. You know, Glastonbury does that. You know, you see a heavy metal band on the Pyramid stage on the Saturday afternoon, followed by, you know, a country act. And that's fine. You know, that can work. You don't need to have to, like... It doesn't all have to be rock, going from light rock, going into heavy rock, into heavy metal. You can mess around.
Exactly. It kind of, if you understand it, it's beautiful, because it stops any competition in that way. It stops trying to be, well, at that festival we were above them. It's like, it's just, this works. It's just go and enjoy the experience.
I'm glad you see it like that. I mean, the amount of phone calls and emails from angry managers and agents, like, what are they doing above us on the bill? Like, it's like... Guys, come on, it's not like, I mean, how do you even do that? Like, what do you do? Add up their Facebook friends, or like how many records they've sold, or what? I mean, what is it? There's some things are obvious, you know, status quo are bigger than like so and so or whatever. But like, when it gets down to the DJs, particularly, the egos there is unbelievable. Like, you know, we are bigger than so and so. Well, like, who says? Like, how do you know that? Like,
Completely. And it's, I mean, over the years, myself and Dan have pretty much played in every slot on every stage, it feels like. And it's never been a, oh, here's the slot that's best, here's what's not. You know, our best ones often have been at kind of an odd time of day, because it just works. And obviously we've got, it feels like a home gig because of Sunday Best and everything else, which we'll get round to. So, we've had lunchtime slots that have been our best shows at Bestival, because that's, it just sits right. But what, there's two things on the headline part I want to discuss. What acts have been the most exciting for you to book? And obviously the good thing is, it is a big, you know, everyone sits around and has their fancy festival type thing. You get to do that in real life. Obviously there is then restrictions of money, but still you get to go, who would I like to have? And then you get to be, hello, I'm Rob the Bank, thank you for coming to my festival, Elton, or you know, whoever else. So who's been, I'll do the first half, who's been your most exciting to kind of, even if it isn't a headliner, just the most exciting to go, wow, I get to have them at my party, essentially?
Crikey, that's so tricky. I mean, you know, I'd say, you know, Kraftwerk and the Beastie Boys in the last sort of 10 years of legendary, you know, influential acts on me, you know, acts, one electronic, obviously more electronic, one in the sort of hip hop world. And for my sort of music and DJing and just, you know, everything, you know, those are sort of lifelong sort of iconic heroes of mine. Probably more recently, you know, having Stevie Wonder and Elton John in two consecutive years, you know, that it's not everyone's, you know, Elton's not everyone's cup of tea. Even Stevie is not absolutely everyone's cup of tea, but they're global icons who have sold more records than most people, you know, most other pop stars combined. And so, and they both turned in absolutely, you know, flawless, kind of amazing, really personal performances where it wasn't just trotting out the stuff. You know, Elton had stories about how he got down to the island and, you know, he never does festivals and, you know, he really believed that Bestival was going to be a good one for him. And, you know, Stevie Wonder, you know, he brought his daughter on stage and he'd had this whole adventure of coming down from London and thinking it was going to take 10 minutes to get to the Isle of Wight. And, you know, it's like he just didn't have a clue. And then the hilarious photos of him going back on the ferry and stuff. So, you know, beautiful. But then Amy Winehouse, you know, she was not in maybe in the best way, but she still delivered. And, you know,
yeah, absolutely amazing. I remember that one really clearly. I think it was one of the first few years, or I'd only been going a few years. And it was just, she was on late and the crowd was all angry and annoyed, but then she comes out and she's Amy Winehouse.
I mean, I was DJing beforehand, so I was off to the side of the stage in a little sort of booth where I couldn't really see the stage, but I could feel the crowd bristling, you know. It was only about 15,000 capacity at that time, but people were really like annoyed, and obviously they knew the whole Amy story. But So I was sort of playing my sort of penultimate record, thinking, right, Amy, you know, she's on at 10:30 or whatever. And then my manager, Ben, tapped me on the shoulder. He goes, she's just left Ventnor. And I was like, oh, my God, you know, that's like 40 minutes away. My mate Keith was driving her. No, totally, man. I had no records left. So I was like, then I had to sort of fill for half an hour. And then my mate Keith was driving her. And he sort of later told me that he'd had to stop off to get her sweets on the way. Like, she wanted to buy some sweets. It was like 10:30 at night. She was supposed to be headlining Bestival. She wanted to get some sweets. And then, I wouldn't lie and say she totally nailed it. It was like her best gig ever, but I thought it was like a really, you know, it was a live experience. Yeah, it was like, completely. Well, this is Amy, you know, it's up and down. And so, yeah, I mean, it's $1 million question. Too many highlights, and then some of the smaller, like, little indie bands and stuff, and hip hop acts and stuff, like loads of things. I mean, Outkast last year were pretty.
I mean, that was
immense.
That's part of my next question, but just one that springs to mind as well, as you were mentioning over there. We went on, I think it was before or maybe just after Gil Scott-Heron on the main stage, and the year before he passed, and that was just an amazing thing to get him there, to have that moment, and it was after he had his comeback, a record that everyone was blown away by, and that was one for me, just as the sun was shining, just seeing a legend kind of frailly coming on stage, but then just being Gil Scott-Heron and just absolutely stunning. But the second part of the headliner's question, who are the ones that have kind of, I don't know, that have surprised you the most, or maybe there was some question over and then they come out and performed? I remember standing side stage with you and watching Florence the Machine, and I remember when that was announced, I love Florence, and I thought, that's a bit much for her at this stage, and then just watching, and she absolutely knocked it out of the park. And Outkast was a similar one. I was completely on board, obviously a massive Outkast fan, but I thought, have they got a headline type set? And then it was my favourite thing of last year's Bestival, just blew me away. They opened with Bombs Over Baghdad. That shows the intent they're coming in with. Confident, casually, just come out and do that. And then, right?
No, you're totally right. I mean, I definitely, you know, I'm a huge Outkast fan, but it's not like I own, you know, every single album and know every single lyric. It's like, you know, in my hip-hop compendium there in the top 10, but I wasn't sure at all. I thought maybe 60 minutes is going to be you know, pretty intense, but totally, you know, they did like pretty much 80 minutes. I mean, everyone was singing along to pretty much everything, and I didn't even know half the words, but I found myself,
it was amazing to realise how many big tracks they've got, because I think I realised obviously everything off of Stankonia was huge, and then there's been a lot, and they did their bits where Big Boy had his little mini solo gig, and then Andre had his mini solo gig, and it kind of all just, it didn't feel like it was any fleshing out.
It was so visual as well. Like, I thought it was going to be, you know, obviously the old hip hop cliche of two blokes great, stood there with it, you know, moodily like nodding their heads, and the Coachella feedback had been so sort of negative when that first happened, and I think they were a bit overawed by how big maybe Coachella was. But I think, man, you know, this show at Bestival, it was like my mum and dad, who know nothing about Outkast, let alone hip hop, were like loving it.
They're more NWA fans, aren't they? They've always been more gangster. Yeah, that's perfect. Is there anyone else that stands out, even not in the headline slot, that stands out as a real kind of a rolling the dice on it, and then it's gone, wow, that just worked?
Oh, God. It's difficult because, you know, nearly everything I book, I obviously believe in and think is going to... I mean, we've had some mad stuff like Will Smith, Will Young.
Yeah,
you know, like pop stuff, and I don't mind. I'm not embarrassed.
And now I want you to have Will Smith, of course.
Yeah, man, I'd love to, yeah. But, you know, so, yeah, I mean, you know, pop stuff goes down well, like Sophie Ellis-Bextor. I'm not snobby about pop music. I love, you know, it's good, and people want to hear a lot of different things. So, but putting it on at Bestival, you just sometimes wonder, God, are people going to get this, or are they just going to, like, sort of start booing? So, I think that's good as well. I think we can pretty much get away with anything. I'd like to think that you could...
It's never had that feel of a Redden Leeds or even a Glastonbury at points where if you put the wrong act on, or the crowd are going to be ready to turn on someone, if you know what I mean. I think the only time I felt it was when a Winehouse was late. That's the only time I felt that crowd kind of... Are ready to be pissed off kind of thing.
That man. I mean, yeah, you probably spent about as much time in those fields at Bestival as I have.
Bestival expert.
But you're right. And I sort of trudge around the fields pretty much non-stop around 20 stages now. And you're right. I've never sort of seen that either, where people are kind of visibly a bit lively.
So the question now is, who would you love to get? And number two, is there anyone you've come close to getting and just missed, or anyone that you can talk about in that manner?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't think it's any secret that me and Prince have got a long a long history of me sending fruitless emails with large amounts of money attached.
And we have... I remember you... telling me about one Prince email, kind of where it hadn't happened, and then after you'd booked everything, they came back, and if it had been a week earlier, it could have happened, and I was just heartbroken. I was having a wonderful Bestival, and then you were kind of revealing this was going to be Prince's slot. I was enjoying this until you said that, because now it's not Prince.
But, you know, 6 weeks before Bestival, I'm sorry, I just don't have that dosh still hanging around. So, but He's my favourite artist of all time, and I totally respect the fact he doesn't want to sort of make a decision on things until the last minute. Yeah. And I think Glastonbury, you know, the last few years have had the same experience with him, where it's
holding out and the rumours there.
What's that?
Just holding out and the rumours start to build and then,
if I was brave enough, then I think I would have... Well, he would have already played at Bestival for sure.
Yeah.
Because and maybe some avid Bestival fan listeners will be going, go on, just hold out for it. Yeah. But it's too much of a risk, because then what happens, you know, he gets a show somewhere else or decides that it's not for him, then you're left without headliners. And that is the biggest stress of sort of booking a festival. Is,
do you think there's any more hope in it now that he's been doing a lot of like the last minute Coco show, just to keep it completely on Prince, like, for example, that he could literally hit, like, headline the second stage or something like that, or headline something smaller, even though it's Prince,
because he's been doing a little set in Bollywood. I mean, I know, I already
send
know
send him a picture of the ship and say you can perform on this.
I already sort of know the full Prince story for this year, and I don't think it's going to involve any UK festivals, sadly. So, but yes, you know, I mean, Dolly Parton, fair play to Glastonbury. You know, it was an absolute standout moment, and amazing. Booking. And we've been after Dolly for 10 years as well, and I'd still do it, even though she's done Glastonbury. I'm not snobbish about that, and you know, I know that. Yeah, she's got a huge fan base at Bestival. So Dolly, Kate Bush, I mean...
Kate Bush would be amazing. Her shows last year were just... I made it along to one and it was just...
Yeah, mind-blowing. Like, one of probably the best live music thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, I'd agree. I certainly couldn't argue with that.
The imagination she'd put into it, like, I wasn't ready for that at all that night. I was not expecting that.
No, I'm the same. And just a reading the program of how it had to be how it was because she needed somewhere that she could fully build and create, and it had to be a residency. It couldn't be a touring thing because she had such specific ideas.
Yeah,
you know. So all I'd say is next year. That separate festival in the festival should just be Kate Bush. Just give her a field and say, look, you can build anything you want.
Yeah. Bushtival. Yeah, no, I mean, we did go back in, to be totally frank, because we've sent her offers over the years. Yeah. But I think, yeah, you know, and she's not totally anti doing a festival, I don't think, but you would have to create some kind of weatherproof, you know, dancing 360 and stage with them.
as much as I'd love to see her in more situations, I tried to get her on the podcast, for example, but I've got nothing but respect for how she does her stuff and runs things. The fact that she's
a mum. Genuinely,
I spoke to her manager about it.
Casually throw that one in.
I did. But I wasn't up for it, and I understand that. But just one of the things that amazed me with the live show was that can never happen again, because that's someone who got huge, toured once, and then walked away from it for 20 years and was a mother. And that was it. There was no temptation to flirt back with touring or live or any of that. It was like, right, no, I've done that. That was fun. Now I'm a mother. I've got a family. I'm living in the real world. And that's, so to then come back from that was mind-blowing. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I was reading a Patti Smith interview the other day about how she said the thing that annoys her most about people's preconceptions of her is that they say, oh, but you didn't do anything in the 80s. And actually, she was having children and raising a family. And I'm sort of, because part of me wants to just sort of not do any, you know, jack it all in and look after my kids and do that. And I think there's a real sort of stigma about, you know, well, what are you doing? You know, you're at home with the kids. It's like, actually, that's kind of a job, you know, that is.
Yeah, that's its own, that's completely, it's got its own merits and is completely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, I mean, Kate Bush has done it the dream way, and you could never have, you couldn't have written that, and she couldn't have hoped it could have turned out any better, that you could disappear for 20 years and then come back and
do that
with the biggest impact of anyone.
And working with her son on it and everything. This has just turned into a Kate Bush podcast now.
Bertie, Kate, we love you. Listen,
amazing.
I mean, come on Pip's podcast, and then once you've done that, then just announce Bestival, Sunday night headliner, 2015, Bosch, we're in. Thank
Perfect.
You.
Perfect. So, I mean, speaking there, it segues perfectly on speaking of the changes that come when you have a family and family life becomes a bigger thing. Was that an influence on launching a Camp Bestival? Because again, there's not, I think a Latitude's great. I think there's a lot of great festivals, but there isn't a single festival that I think caters more to children and family than Camp Bestival. And still the biggest turnout I've ever seen was Mr. Tumble's set on the main stage at lunchtime at Camp Bestival. And it was just, yeah.
It's depressing, isn't it?
No, it's amazing. Yeah, and again, that's the last highlight. I've played every year since it started, and the biggest turnout has been Mr. Tumble's at lunchtime.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Closely followed by you. Yeah. But no, I think, firstly, it's brilliant that, you know, you and Dan and you on your own, you know, with your spoken word lounge and stuff, have done all, you know, Camp Bestival, because I think some people look at it and go, oh, it's just a fluffy family festival, but actually it's a family of like so many different sides. It's like, it's a rave up on the one hand, it's a, you know, we had House of Pain on the main stage. It's not that sort of fluffy thing, and it's on the other hand, it's a very safe sort of family festival. And we did have to create it, you know, with that in mind. So yeah, as soon as we started having kids, we were like, okay, so what's it going to be like in 3 or 4 years when the kids actually want to start coming? And, you know, Bestival's a bit racy and maybe a bit full on for kids. And although I think since we started Camp Bestival, we've actually made Bestival more family friendly as well.
Yeah, I'd agree. Areas are
some areas,
up,
and
yeah,
and a lot more people are coming from the Isle of Wight now with their families in the day, and then maybe the kids are going off site and stuff. So I'd love that to keep going like that, you know, like you see at Glastonbury, people towing their kids around in wheelbarrows or like little carts and stuff.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, Camp Bestival, you know, I think we nailed it. We just happened to sort of spot that niche, which is now, obviously, there's hundreds of, well, not hundreds, but loads of family festivals. But I'd like to think we kind of do it best. I think we have so much content, and we spend an awful lot of money and time on that sort of content to make sure that every kid, whether they're a girl or a boy, whether they're sort of able-bodied, disabled, you know, whatever, you know, 2 years old, 20, well, not 20, because they wouldn't be a kid, but, you know, 16, they're catered for, whether they like grime or whether they like ballet, and it's like, so you've got to tick so many boxes, it's like...
Completely. I remember going, I think it was the year that Mr. Tumbles was on, walking up the hill after him and seeing Kate Tempest in Sound of Rum at that point, so a good 3 years ago, whatever it was, and then I'm sure it was a Lethal Bizzle that night in the Big Top or something like that, and just having that variation of like, yeah, it's okay to cater to all of these things, because once you put the kids to bed, one of the parents is allowed to go out and have fun. That's how it works,
preferably,
right?
Preferably not both of you, because then there'll be like a small child wandering around the campsite going, please come back from Underworld, because I, you know, I'm here in my pyjamas.
So well, so let's. This is completely asked about face here, but let's go back to your introduction into music, into DJing. You grew up in Portsmouth, right? Hey, well, what were your musical influences, and what were you into growing up, and then what made you decide to start DJing, and the kind of combination, the mix between. Me and Yoda discussed this in the podcast, that there's DJ means two things, and you're one of the DJs who can do both of these things. There's DJs who DJ at club nights, and there's DJs who host a radio show, and they are separate skills and both worth their own thing, but often it's not as much of a crossover. So what was your path into DJing, and what influenced you and made you want to get behind them decks?
It's quite a traditional and sort of classical and boring. It's not like I was like watching, you know, like early hip hop scratch sort of videos or anything. It was like I was, my dad had a brass band, and I started playing the trombone in that when I was 10 or something like that. And I was like, you know, listening to his record collection at home, like the Beatles and the Mamas and the Papas and sort of, you know, 70s stuff, and then listening to like Adam Ant and Culture Club on the radio, and then playing the trombone. So that was like my early musical, you know, it wasn't like I was into the Sex Pistols or like Eric B and Rakim and stuff. It was not trendy. And then I suppose gradually, you know, I sort of discovered John Peel about that time. Then Manchester hit Manchester. Mm. It also weirdly hit sort of, well, everywhere, you know, Portsmouth, Southampton was... Everyone was suddenly wearing flares and had beads and sort of Ian Brown t-shirts on. And so, yeah, you know, 14, 15, I was like, suddenly it was a bit of a scene happening. Same time as that, I got really into bands like Ride and Slowdive and Pale Saints, a kind of shoegaze scene. Yeah. So, yeah, bands were coming to Portsmouth Guildhall, Southampton Guildhall. The South Coast, you know, that's why we're doing Common People there. That's why we do Bestival there. Yeah. It's really badly served by music.
It really is.
It's got some beautiful venues.
It's one of the things that people always tweet us and hit us up saying, are you coming down even to Anuki and Cornwall and things like that? It's like, if we get booked, we will, but you can't... It's a misunderstanding on how touring works. We can't just turn up there. Like, we could, but it'd be horrible for everyone. Yeah, they are weirdly poorly serviced areas, yet there's loads of people, there's loads of beautiful venues. I remember the first time we played in Bournemouth, we were like, oh, this is going to be a bit crap. And we got there, it was one of the most beautiful old concert halls you've ever been in. And it's,
No, there are the venues there. So, and to be fair to the people of Portsmouth and Southampton and the South Coast, they are doing a much better job. And there are some brilliant young promoters and some older promoters who are trying to make it happen. But anyway, I was just setting the scene that there wasn't a lot going on. I wasn't growing up in like Camden or like inner city Manchester or whatever. I wasn't surrounded by... I was living in a little village, cycling around on my bike, on my BMX, in my shorts, listening to like the Stone Roses or whatever. So it was kind of quite a sort of traditional villagey sort of chilled out thing. And then it wasn't until probably I went to London when I was 18, and then I was this sort of white middle class kid. I got into Goldsmiths and got dropped off in Deptford by my sister. You know, didn't realise I was in one of the liveliest areas of South London. You know, got mugged like three or four times within 2 weeks. Got adopted sort of by my crack dealer mugger who Mickey, who I still sort of remember to this day, who Brilliant. Sort of took me under his wing and then looked after me from then on, and no one else touched me in South London ever. But it was a real sort of baptism of fire. Like, he took me to the Wimpy at gunpoint to buy him a Wimpy with the money that he'd just stolen out of my cash point. So it was like I was totally sort of just dropped in it. I think 2 weeks in, I bought the Ragga Twins debut album and was just like, suddenly I was like, oh right, okay, this makes a lot of sense. Fabio and Groove Rider were running Rage at Heaven, you know, like legendary sort of hardcore / early jungle club.
Yeah.
There were trance raves going on in Battersea Power Station. It was like, yeah, suddenly I was like, this is what it's all about, guys. Yeah, so
this is it.
I totally sort of landed, and I was DJing already a bit, and so, but you know, I was going to see Giles Peterson and Norman Jay doing Shake and Finger Pop sort of funk nights. On the other hand, I was going to trance raves in a pair of bright orange trousers.
Yeah.
And then the next night I might be going to, you know, see Fabio and Groove Rider or whatever. So it was that sort of amazingly exciting time in London when there was so many scenes kind of kicking off.
It's just given me a brief memory here, which is completely unrelated. And I mean, on Sunday Best, you released a Cure live album, but my mate Rick went to see The Cure once and got there and walked along, and obviously a queue of people all in black, and he'd gone in bright orange trousers because he's just this is what I'm wearing. It's like fancy seeing if you're turning up at a Cure gig in bright orange trousers. Let's move on to radio DJ now, because you mentioned the legendary John Peel there, and if I remember rightly, you filled in after he sadly passed. So how was that to get to a point? I mean, number one, what was the kind of entry? But to get to a point where you're the guy stepping in when someone who you wouldn't be doing this if you hadn't heard, or has probably influenced a lot of your musical taste, let alone DJing or radio style or anything like that, and you're taking up the reins to kind of fill the boots there.
Yeah, I mean, very good question. It sounds like a total fantasy, even looking back on it, like in good and bad ways. I never intended on doing radio, much like I didn't intend on having a record label, DJing, running a festival, getting married, having kids, or...
wanted to cycle about in your shorts and just chill.
Listening to the Stone Roses. I'd have been quite happy, 41, still riding my BMX around Wasash, you know. But no, I think I'd started Sunday Best the Club, and that was really well known. I'd sort of, you know, nationally as a sort of place where this sort of chill out, which is sort of became a dirty word, but you know, Groove Armada, Lemon Jelly, Bonobo, early Bonobo stuff like True Thoughts, and all that sort of stuff was coming through. Fatboy Slim, Basement Jacks were DJing there, Harvey, Weatherall. It was like, you know, it's amazing sort of 99p club to get into, and we had the sort of cream of the sort of left field coming through there. And I think Radio 1 had noticed that they had a chill out show called, I think, you know, it was called The Blue Room at that time, which didn't have a presenter, and they thought, we need a presenter for this. And they got me and Chris Coco both in to sort of battle against each other and do a pilot, and they liked us both, so they gave us both the show. And
amazing.
So suddenly I was on Radio 1, and you know, I thought, okay, well, this will last a couple of weeks or maybe a month at best. And then 12 years later,
I
was still there. But, that's sort of setting the scene of how I ended up even gracing the airwaves at Radio 1. Yeah. And then probably 3 or 4 years into that, then I'd obviously just about found my feet by then and felt slightly more confident, but still absolutely shit scared every time I went into Radio 1, particularly when, you know, the late, great John Peel was sat at his desk, because we all used to go into, sit in a big room together. And so, you know, Annie Nightingale was over there, Marianne Hobbs was there, you know, Trevor Nelson, Fabian Groove Rider, you know, absolutely amazing, all my heroes in one room. And then, you know, and John Peel, who was... you know, he didn't suffer fools, but he was also the loveliest man in the world.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I would, you know, literally, I would summon up the courage for like 10 minutes to just say hello as I walked past him, and you might get a grunt or something in reply.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was like, John Peel just grunted at me. It's like, my life is complete. But so this is all just to set the scene that it was how big a deal it was. And then you know, obviously, well, I was trekking down a hill in Morocco on a camel with Josie, as you do, on a donkey, sorry,
so
not a camel.
So many stories of start like that.
and I got a call on my early mobile phone saying, John's going away next in 2 weeks or whatever. Can you stand in for his show for 3 nights? And I was like, yeah, you know, you're joking, aren't you? It's like total lifetime ambition. So totally crapping myself, you know, got home and got ready for those. Got into the studio on
ran
the day.
Ran off the camel.
What's that?
Ran off the camel. I'll explain later.
Left the donkey in Morocco. But got to Radio 1 that day. I've always sort of, apart from today, pride myself on sort of being punctual and the first guy in the office and, you know, always super keen. And I think that's, you know, an important thing to do. So I was there sort of 8 o'clock in the morning for a show that started at 10 o'clock that night or something. Yeah. And then Ian Parkinson, one of the guys who was one of the bosses, sort of very soberly looked around, sort of knocked on the door and came in, and he was like, "Where is everyone?" And I was like, "Well, I'm the only one here." And then about 2 minutes later, he came back and he said, "Right, Rob, come upstairs, I need to talk to you." And basically sat me down and said, "You know, I've got some very sad news. John Peel's died." And like, I was one of the first people, because it wasn't like public at that point, so they'd obviously been told. And so suddenly I was like, you know, what a weird scenario. I'm supposed to be sitting in for John Peel on his radio show that night, and he's just died in Peru. And I'm like, oh God, you know, just like mad panic.
Yeah, of course.
So there was mad panic in Radio 1 because no one knew what to do. Everyone was devastated. Obviously, you know, all the DJs started coming in, Steve Lamacq and Marion Hobbs, all, you know, everyone went down to the pub and drank red wine as they hoped John would have liked them to have done. And we all sat there wondering what was going to happen. And then fortunately someone made the bright move not to let me do the show that night. And I think Marianne and Lamo did it.
Yeah.
But then, from the next week on, then I had, I don't know, about 6 weeks or 2 months worth of John Peel shows to do. So it was kind of huge boots to fill. But
yeah, definitely.
I mean, looking back on it, one of most life-changing, inspirational things to happen to me, because I sort of totally embraced, I already was very sort of Catholic in my taste, but I think I saw, because the way he kept all his records, you know, a lot of vinyl, some CDs.
Yeah.
He had marks on everything.
All with meticulous.
Like number 4 track is 5 stars out of, you know, 5 out of 5.
Wow.
This one's 4 out of 5. He'd pretty much written his next 3 week shows in, you know, I timed it specifically. He hated it if he finished, you know, 3 seconds over time.
Wow.
So it was kind of easy in a way. I was just following his orders, you know, his sort of invisible orders. But but yeah, mad old experience.
And did that influence your future shows, I guess? Because it felt after that you kind of really, it opened up, kind of your show became a show that, when I had Zane on, it was kind of similar that he was saying he was one of the first shows on, he went there expecting to have to do a rock show and was told just play anything, you know, go where you want. And your show and Hugh Stevens, probably the two that strike me as having that similar kind of setup of, you will have a set kind of tone, but you'll be free to go off on tangents and try bits from here and there and kind of play what you want. And was that, did that influence things from there, from going from essentially a chill out and that's kind of your area thing to being, right, I need to champion a lot of kinds of music and I need to bring music to people who aren't aware that they would like it, or bring new music through and things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. I mean, obviously, as I've hopefully sort of explained, that, you know, out of the chill out electronica thing, I was a Cure fan. I was like, it's the Smiths, Napalm Death, kind of, happy hardcore. Like, I had huge taste. So in a way, it was suddenly a relief. It was like, okay. So
I can express all of these things.
And obviously I didn't, you know, there was no point in trying to be as diverse as John, because John just believed in it so fully, you know, that he'd play the Fool next to Happy Hardcore, next to Steel Pulse, next to Benjamin Zephaniah, next to, you know, a mad sort of grime track, and he could get away with it. And I don't think anyone else could ever get away with it like he could, because he just believed in it so much.
Yeah,
anyone else would sound like they were just trying to be different.
Trying to be crazy and wacky,
Hey guys, look at this mix. But I think it did open up I think it opened up radio as well, because, you know, me and Hugh both got the sort of, what was it called? oh, I can't remember what they called the slot after that, but it was supposed to be a bit more diverse. And until that point, you know, it's like Fabian Grewrider had the drum and bass show, so and so had the techno show, so and so had and at that point John had been doing his thing, but no one else had really been mixing it up. And you know, Zane was coming in at that point and doing his thing. Me and Hugh were kind of mixing it up a bit more. So yeah, it was great, and it was really liberating to think that I could play more different styles on the radio. And you know, and I pretty much did until I left there last year. So it's been, you know, 12 absolutely unbelievable years. I can't believe that I did 12 years at Radio 1.
It's amazing, right?
At what point and what made you decide to start a label? Because I know, or some people won't know the kind of story of our relationship essentially, but I know that you are one of the first people supporting us, and we spoke to you early on, and we were having all these major labels kind of courting us, and you were someone who was always just advising us and saying, well, you know, be careful of this, be careful of that. And for us, it was that point where we sat down and went, well, this is a guy that we trust and has got his own label. Why are we looking in these other areas? And it seemed like a perfect match to come with you guys at Sunday Best. But it felt like when you first suggested it or put it there as an option for us, you were the home of people who might not know they have a home or need a home, or do you know what I mean, kind of thing initially. And was that an influence for you? Was people that, was there music that you were finding and going, how is this not signed? This is awesome. I'm playing it on the show. It's great. How have they not got a label? Did that kind of influence you going, well, they have now, essentially?
Yeah, I know, totally. I think, I mean, the label started a couple of years after Sunday Best the Club started. And so I was... loads of DJs were coming down playing loads of amazing tracks or records that weren't necessarily released, and I was like, wow, these have got to get released. So I started doing some compilations, and then that I met Sarah Bolshe, our beloved Bolshe, and she sort of helped me set up the label, and then it was so much a hobby. Probably probably until I signed you guys that which I shouldn't say now, it's just a hobby, but it was one of, you know, a few things that I do, and it's just music I love. It's not really any more difficult than that. So, you know, whether it's Kitty Days in Lewis, you guys, David Lynch, you know, Valerie June, it's very diverse. Maybe like my taste, you know, Bestival or my radio show, but I think it sort of hangs together. I don't really know what a typical Sunday Best Recordings fan might look like, but
yeah, I was going to say exactly that. That seems to have bled into everything you do. That there's not a typical. It's not typical, if you know what I mean. Because if you look at Kitty Daisy and Lewis, who I think are great. In fact, I'll give a little plug now. My sometime directing partner Tom Coles has just done two of their videos and is about to do a third, and
Did you do that one with the hearse?
Yeah, yes.
Oh, yeah, that's brilliant.
So it's turned me back onto them where I hadn't been keeping up to date, and it's absolutely amazing and things like that. So, but as acts, me and Dan were electronic, rapping, talking. Kitty Daisy and Lewis would pretty much initially scared of electricity, I think, would generally avoid any power. And, it's, you know, it couldn't be further apart, but sat perfectly together, and it all worked on that label. So, again, it's kind of, you seem to have, I don't know if intentionally or just stumbled upon a nice mix of going, look, it's just good. It doesn't matter that it's not all fit into, it's just good. It's music I like, it's music. I guess there's kind of a theme of, I know there's kind of a friendliness or a positivity theme with Sunday Best. I don't know if I'm imagining that because of the brightness of the artwork and how you put it all across. Or
I think I love the feeling like it's a family and not in a sort of hippy dippy, let's all get into bed together. But you know, maybe one day
a little bit in a hippy dippy.
it's like a family. And I think, you know, if you look at Domino or XL or any of the labels that I love, you know, that they do have a sort of family vibe, and they also release very diverse music from lots of different artists, but somehow it all hangs together. And, you know, I'm an XL fan, but there's things on the label I don't like, but there's lots I do like. And I suspect the same with Sunday Best, where some people love Dan Lesac versus Scroobius Pip and David Lynch, but they can't get their heads around Kitty Daisy and Lewis, and other people like Lucky Elephant and Valerie June, and, you know, other people like the more electronic stuff. And And we don't have to be everything for everyone. No. It's like...
That's exactly it. This is going to annoy you now because I was particularly proud of it. But the slogan I came up for my label, Speech Development, was we may not be for you and that's fine. And I think that does just sum it up. It's like, it's all right. I'm not going to get mad at you for not liking everything that we put out.
Apologising for your label.
Yeah. No, exactly. It's always blown my mind when people will tweak. Like I announced... one of the podcast guests recently, and they were like, I love their first record, I didn't like anything after that. It's like, all right. Yeah, that's cool. That you've just said you love their first record. You don't need the second part. You don't need the second part of that. It's like, you know, again, so it can be, I love Kitty and Daisy Lewis. I don't like Dan and Pip. It's like,
yeah.
Fine. That's you shouldn't apologise for that. Yeah. That shouldn't be an issue. That's completely acceptable. It's taste.
Well, record shopping is pretty simple, isn't it? You go and buy what you like, and if you know the fact that there's a label behind something doesn't mean you have to buy everything else on that label. I also think people don't give people enough credit. You know, I think Best of All, Sunday Best Recordings, they're all very, you know, but they don't sit still. Maybe I've got a low boredom threshold and I move on. Like my DJ set's probably much to the ire of people that have listened to me. I can't play more than three house records in a row. If I'm playing a house set, I have to drop in some drum and bass or a grind track or something. I just can't sit still. So it's probably a bit the same with the label that, you know, Kitty, Daisy and Lewis, Valerie June, maybe they're kind of in the similar thing. So, hey, let's go and do David Lynch, or let's go and do L.A. Salami, who was signing at the moment, or do something totally off the wall, and not just for the sake of it, but actually because we can. And also, I really think that people do love diversity. I think there's some people that just want, you know, the same food every day, and they want to listen to the same records and watch the same TV show. But I reckon human nature is that you want to keep going. You don't want to be treading water. You want to be, you know, expanding your brain. And by listening to lots of different music or watching lots of different films or listening to lots of different people talking, it sort of does that. And that's my curiosity about the world is kind of driven like that. And I think maybe that's why I like a lot of different things on the label.
Like, this is good. What else is good? Rather than just, this is good, let's stick with this. This is great, but what else is great? And I think, again, it's kind of, it all comes back to, it shows how, in a way, John Peel has such a lasting influence in, as you were saying, his show, the variation in his show worked because he believed it. And I think that's the same with Sunday Best and with Best of All. It works because it's stuff that you're just into. It's not going, right, we need to sign a metal act now. Because, you know, that's the one thing we've not had. Yeah, it's going, if something comes up, totally. It works.
But just quickly, while we're on that, because we can't gloss over the your illustrious history on the label.
Yes.
And also the crown and glory, well, in my eyes, of your last show at Best of All, which we should touch on.
It was hugely emotional for us. And it's as soon as me and Dan decided that we were going to call it a day, and again, it wasn't for any negativity. It was like, we always set out to do three albums, and that was the deal we did with you guys. At that point in the industry, not many people expected to get through three albums. People like, who we were touring with a lot of the time, people like Kate Nash and Jack Pagnotti and people like that were amazing, but and have continued to go on to do stuff, but sometimes not on the same label or sometimes stopping. So it meant a lot for us to achieve that. And as soon as we decided that, we looked and thought, well, if we're going to end touring, you know, we always play Best of All. It's Best of All. I don't know what we'd do if we weren't there. So it seemed like a natural end. And after we'd announced it was our last one, we then got some freshers offers and things like that all, as you'll know, are quite good money often. And we decided to go, no, we've decided on this. And as soon as that gig started, with you introducing, obviously, again, the guy who signed us and brought us to Best of All the first times. And the first time we played Best of All, it was on that same stage, but we were on, I think it was while Underworld or someone was setting up, so we were literally on a little raised platform at the front. I was standing on the DJ booth, and it was just, it felt like that was our first time there and felt like our first big festival experience. So it felt like a perfect and, the album had been the biggest of our relationship together. The tours had been, and that Best of All crowd was just amazing.
I mean, the crowd, because I've stood on that stage for so many different acts, and yeah, the love in that tent was remarkable, and you know, the sort of 18-year-old kids just leaping up and down and sitting on each other's shoulders and chanting every single word of your record. So thank you very much for deciding to do that there, and all the emotional. And all the amazing records and tunes.
Yeah, completely. I mean, it's as I touched on it, it's always felt the best of all was the home crowd. I remember us doing the main, and I've got a picture on my laptop as my screensaver, in fact, was 1 year on the main stage, and it was in the middle of the day, and we looked out and you couldn't see the end of the people, and it was like, that wasn't where we were at that point, that was only where we were at Bestival, if you know what I mean. Any other festival that year we would have had a fraction of that, but at Bestival, that there were that many people and they were there intentionally. It wasn't just they were passing, and that was a real kind of, it's why it made the perfect place to end it all. But no, speaking
they were
of
waiting, they were waiting for Elton.
We've just tipped over the hour mark, so I'll bring it to a close, but I just want to ask what's next. Obviously you're on Six Music now, and you've just announced Bestival Canada. I know you've spoken for years of wanting to do a Bestival Mexico and just all sorts of other things. What's ahead in this crazy busy world of yours?
Yeah, if anyone in Mexico is listening and you want to put on a festival there, then we're up for it. Bestival Toronto has just launched, so we just announced that.
And how's that going to work? Is that going to be a lot of a lot more American and Canadian acts on? Is the booking going to be influenced or changed, or is it going to be a similar kind of?
Well, again, if you're not leaking this information before, on Monday we're announcing Florence and Nas as two headliners.
Oh, wow.
And then like Caribou and Flostradamus and
amazing.
And then things like Rudimental and Clean Bandit from the UK. So it's a real mixed bill. I mean, I'm glad I
got Nas. You're going to have to get Run the Jewels, as he's signed them now, and they're going off so much. So
I'm not having much luck with Run the Jewels this year. I couldn't do Bestival, and I'm not sure they could do that either. But sore point.
Yeah. about that.
No, it's fine. But plenty more hip hop in the sea.
There is.
So Bestival Toronto. We've launched Common People, which is a new show for us in Southampton, like a day show. We've got Fatboy and Grace Jones doing that.
Oh, amazing.
I think, finally after 12 years, we've been brave enough to go, okay, these are definitely the right people to do this with. We're going to keep that going. We're feeling confident about what we're doing in that. Personally, I'm still doing radio with Six Music, but my real priority for the next few years is sort of soundtracking, is music supervision.
Oh, wow.
So I've got my first score for a feature film this year, which is ridiculous.
Amazing.
Seeing as I can't play the piano or the guitar, so that's very much what I want to sort of be doing, and we might have an American feature film that we're going to be doing. So I think I don't like sitting still, Pip. Like I say, that treading water thing is worrying to me. So you've got to keep moving, and I love doing radio. I love putting out records. I love booking the festivals. I love DJing, in clubs. But I don't like doing any of them
individually, as the one.
As the one thing that I could never be a career DJ, going around the country doing gig after gig. So, I'm so lucky. I've had an amazing career of being able to do all those different things somehow, and it's all just happened so accidentally. But I have been very lucky. So watch this space. I might be like giving it all up to be like a landscape gardener next week or a chartered surveyor. I don't know, but
that'd be wonderful. There's always a tendency at the end of interviews to ask where people can keep up to date. But even if I was going to ask that, it's impossible with you, because there's Rob the Bank, there's separate profiles for Bestival, for Camp Bestival, for Sunday Best. So my thing in general is if you want to keep up to date, just Google anything you heard. In fact, we put this podcast on an app called Acast, and we tag everything in there.
Okay,
so every time we've talked about anything, there will have been a link. So even if you've not listened to it on Acast, if you go and download it on Acast, it'll have all the tags at the side, so you can find out links to all of the things that we've discussed, and hopefully some embarrassing pictures of myself and Rob on there, just flashing up every now and then.
Definitely,
just for fun.
We have to make sure there's some of those on there.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you
to chat.
For coming in. This is my office, not yours.
Sorry, that's right. Thank you for letting me in.
Thanks, Pip. Absolute pleasure.
Yeah, I look forward to Camp Bestival and Bestival and many more.
Yeah, see you down there, man.
You've been listening to Scroobius Picks Discretion Pieces.
That was Rob the Bank, and that was generally an emotional conversation, man. I was welling up as we talked about A Best of All and everything he's done for us. And yeah, what a lovely dude. I love Rob the Bank. I'm just going to put it out there and say, interesting, actually, I got a tweet this week from Julian, who records under the name of Tithe, who used to work at Sunday Best. It's a little snippet of information from my history, which I didn't know at the time because they didn't tell me and Dan in case it killed the vibe. But When Thou Shalt Always Kill was getting its daytime a radio play. It turns out someone, a mum, wrote a handwritten letter to the radio to say, or to the radio, to the label, Sunday Best, to say that we would have blood on our hands because of our song instructing people to kill, which I found hilarious. and even more hilarious, that's Sarah Bolshe, who's mentioned in the podcast there, apparently decided not to let us know because it might have killed the vibe. Because that was early on in our relationship. They didn't know that we would have found that absolutely hilarious. Thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed this one, I'd recommend you check out the Billy Bragg one, the Kate Tempest one, obviously, the Sage Francis one, for an interesting outlook on running the label on the American side of the globe. So plenty to check out. Please subscribe. I go on about it every week. It really helps. We're going to try and do two podcasts next week as well. Yeah, it's a struggle to get them all in, but I reckon we can do it. So subscribe and you will find out who those two podcasts are. See you all next week, I hope. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.